that to me is where the black market is winning, the industry is losing, and ultimately the government is perpetuating this.
Welcome to another episode of Cannabis Law in Canada. I'm Russell Bennett, a cannabis lawyer in Toronto. With me today is Robert Lorry, the president and founder of Ad Lucem Law Corporation. His legal and consultancy practice focuses on commercial, business, regulatory issues, and constitutional legalities surrounding cannabis and psychedelic plant medicines. He has 18 years of policy development and legal practice, and as a lawyer in Canada, Robert works to reform drug laws. He is very busy as a special advisor to Gateway Proven Strategies, GPS Global, a Denver-based cannabis management consultancy firm operating globally, and serves as a board advisor to MAPS Canada, The Last Prisoner Project, and Spore Denver. He also advises Heroic Hearts Project UK, is a founder of the McKenna Academy of Natural Philosophy, and is a director with the Ecuador Amazon Restoration Project. We talk about why he became a lawyer, how he overcame personal challenges and disabilities, and his views on how Canada legalized cannabis and how we could have done it better. But before we begin our chat with Robert, please consider visiting LexisNexis Canada at lexisnexis.ca, a great legal publisher with great dozens of digital legal services for all sizes of law firms. LexisNexis is committed to innovation and helping lawyers practice law better. They publish hundreds of legal textbooks, including my legal textbook, Canada's Cannabis Act, Annotation and Commentary, now in its third edition. Think about buying a copy for a loved one, which features a dark and daunting chapter on the history of the cannabis prohibition that every Canadian needs to know about. Check it out in the store at lexisnexis.ca. Also, please consider signing my petition, where I call upon the Government of Canada to continue its efforts in redressing the harms of 95 years of unscientific and racist cannabis prohibition by, number one, acknowledging that the law never should have existed in the first place, and number two, granting expungements, not pardons, to Canadian citizens convicted of cannabis offenses. You can find it by searching for cannabis at the website petitions.ourcommons.ca. It's number E3752. Now on to my chat with Robert Lorry. I hope you enjoy. Welcome, Robert Lorry, to the podcast.
Russell Bennett, thank you for hosting me and having me as a guest, and really looking forward to our dialogue today.
Oh, me too. This is so exciting. We had a brief I wouldn't say brief. We talked for quite a bit on the phone before just to get acquainted. And I feel like you're a brother from another mother in a way. It's just incredible. We're both fathers. We're both juggling parenthood, trying to stay married, and running a law practice out of your house. Could you explain to me a bit about what your chaotic day has been like so far, just to ground us here?
Sure. Well, I used to have chaotic days outside of the house. I mean, I have an office in Vancouver, which I used to spend loads of time on. And then we moved to the island and COVID hit. So the home office has been, a great transition in many regards, because having small children and being in charge of my own hours means, as long as you're hitting the deadlines, you can kind of do work at home or out or, any number of places. And so it's really been great in terms of recognizing that, long as you got your laptop and a pad of paper and a pen, can work for almost anywhere. But having small kids and being able to be with them and watch them grow and play a significant part in their development is truly phenomenal. Because before I turn it back over to you, having worked as a lawyer in big British and American law firms, you'd have these older partners effectively would almost alienate their families with workload. But yet it was this two-tiered thing of making so much money, but never being home. And then the family being accustomed to a lifestyle that you can't walk away from. Well, the good news, and it sounds like you're in the same boat, is we're able to achieve that professional personal balance, which is really half the battle in the legal profession.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was almost impossible for a lawyer to leave, to go home for like a dinner, you know, because you'd have to stay to late hours of the night and then do it all over again. And you have these 12-hour, 14-hour days. And that was the gold standard, really. And that's, I mean, so it's so toxic to family life, to your own personal health. You have no balance. You're totally unbalanced. So you're alienated from your kids. You're trying to provide for your kids, but you're alienated from them because you never see them. So what's the point?
A vicious cycle.
Right? Yeah.
Do you remember, I kind of look at life before BlackBerries and PDAs and life after, because I was an articling student in England. And, you know, this is going back like 2004. So, you know, partners had BlackBerries and then associates got BlackBerries. And then there was the decision that trainee solicitors would get BlackBerries. And like before, you had waiting time where you would just sit around because you didn't know if documents from Royal Bank of Scotland or Bank of America were going to come in to be able to close a due diligence or a deal. So you literally had waiting time. Where, you know, we'd be ordering food and packs of cigarettes in those days and billing it to Royal Bank of Scotland on waiting time.
Right.
Whereas then when you got the PDAs and the BlackBerries, at least it was, okay, you could get away from the office, sneak off to the gym or go home, but you were kind of on standby. And what's nice to see 20 years later is at least we're seeing jurisdictions with right to shut off and, you know, right to switch off. Because again, that balance got so out of whack where partners, you know, or anyone for that matter could access you,
yes.
That it led to, I guess, you know, creating personal boundaries and expectations with clients. But having worked for big American law firms, I mean, it's funny, we were closing a deal and I was the articling student and the American lawyer says to the British lawyer, it's like, all right, looks like we'll be able to close Saturday. What are you doing? And it's like, well, I'm getting married. The American partner said, the British partner said, the New York partner without skipping a beat. Well, what are you doing Sunday? Like that was just the mentality, right? A bit, you know, good way to like just, you know, show the difference between the British partner and the American New York partner.
Right.
But there you have it.
Oh my God. Okay. Why law? Why are you a lawyer? Why? We'll get to cannabis law in a second, but just in general, like I am always very curious because lawyers are a particular breed of human. What is it about the law itself that attracted you, and when and how did you get on that journey?
Well, I had a grandfather who always wanted my father to be a lawyer, and my dad never became a lawyer. And I mean, my grandfather was the CFO of a major construction company that, you know, did in like Coquihalla Highway, George Massey Tunnel, Arthur Lang Bridge, I mean, the Alex Fraser Bridge, like big projects. And he just always saw the value of a legal mind. And I mean, he was an accountant by trade, a CA, and just really, it fascinated me as a kid because you try to argue or debate with him and he'd always bring in the law. And so you'd realize that, plus my parents' friends who were all lawyers, seemed to be doing very well in their career. And it seemed to be an interesting mix of a lawyer between like art and science. And I mean, more art than science. And well, I'm dyslexic and have effectively a learning disability. So technically law is probably the last profession that I naturally should have gone into. But why for me is the ability to be a voice for those that don't have one. And if you can get to the law and point to something, then it really boils down to two words. And it was the first thing I learned in criminal law at Oxford University was Adrian Briggs QC, who was our tutor, which is your in college professor who's responsible for your law studies. He basically said at the beginning, you know, you can do and say whatever you want, But there will come a time that I, as a judge or authority figure for that matter, will say two words, and that is show me. Show me, Mr. Lori, show me, Mr. Bennett, where it says, you know, you have standing or grounds for that. So being a kid that was, you know, also ADHD, still am, which, you know, ties into being a medical cannabis user. But I always liked debating and standing up for arguments and having the ability to articulate my position. And so for me, law just seemed like a natural fit.
How did you navigate reading when you're dyslexic and when you have ADHD and it's impossible to train your focus? It sounds like you must have overcome some serious personal hurdles to get to where you are.
You know, thank you for asking that question and acknowledging that, because again, it's just, you grow up as a kid thinking everyone's the same and so on. And I mean, talking about ADHD was actually only something I've been comfortable talking about in the last 10 years, even as an articling student requalifying in Canada. And there was a stigma attached to it, right? And more so in the UK, because they're like 20 years behind in certain respects, certainly when it comes to overprescribing medications like in North America, which for someone like myself who was diagnosed at age 4, again, it was just, you had to learn ways of looking at weaknesses. And if you could develop strategies for weaknesses, then sometimes your weaknesses could almost become strengths. At least if you know you have weaknesses and blind spots, you can do things about it. So that enabled me, through school effectively to, I don't know, cope and succeed, which I have to thank my parents. But it was third year university that through further psychometric testing ended up, you know, showing that I had a gifted learning disability. That sounds really arrogant, but conceited. But it means I could do certain things really, really well. And then other things, you know, I'd be in like the 13th percentile, right? But so I had strengths that certainly could compensate for my weaknesses. And so like Oxford, why Oxford for law? Well, you know, your exams is what it boils down to. And you do final honor school exams in your third year, which means your law degree is basically based on 3 years worth of work that you're doing. You're in college tutorials, you're attending university lectures, but over that 2.5 year period, you know, you may not be doing your land law tutorial when the university is doing lectures, for example. So none of it makes sense. And it's all Socratic method. And they just give you lists each week to read. And that's what, you know, people at Oxford, they say, what are you reading? I'm reading law, or I read law. And that's what I loved about it, because there was no spoon feeding, right? Compared to when I came back to Canada, I had to requalify as a lawyer. So I was lucky. Evidence and corporate and constitutional law, I was able to sit on those classes. But it blew my mind that, you know, our exams at Oxford were 9 exams in 13 days based on 3 years worth of work. They weren't open book. You were given a statute book that wasn't cracked yet. And if you had to refer to a statute book, it was almost like you hadn't done your prep. Versus in Canada, open book exams, and you're literally just getting spoon fed each week, open book exam. And then it's like, how do you fail? Or how, you know, you got to really mess up law school not to get through it. But to me, there was just really something about going to a university that prepares you to learn and think and be self-reliant. And, you know, that plus everything else discussed, you know, it's kind of led me to where I am now.
Excellent. So yeah, the challenges you face, you say you turn into tools almost, and ways to kind of like superpowers in a way, really.
You know, that's accurate, because, you know, I can remember my first cup of coffee, because I was being given coffee at the age of 4 to see, you know, whether or not that would ramp up or focus me. And then taking Ritalin at the age of four, like we're talking weapons grade speed that they give, you know, naval aviators for high altitude dogfighting. I mean, Ritalin is basically go pills. But in my case, it would slow me down. It would calm me to the point where instead of being that unfocused, distracted student, I would become ultra focused. Right. And so during school, it was either I really got something or I was the teacher's worst nightmare, which, again, when you got to understand rights and rules and how to function amongst society, well, law is a great profession because it really sets a marker and a guidepost for this is the line and this is why self-regulation is important. And to me, having a career in a profession that studies those rules and where the line can go, and with a ever-changing profession that's not static, with the ability to look at lots of different areas and be evolving. I mean, for someone like me, I can't think of a better profession than law.
All right. So was cannabis, when cannabis was introduced into your life, was it to assist with the medical issues, or was it as recreational?
Well, it was my younger brother's best friend growing up was made a couple wrong turns in his life. We were all at private school together. Well, and he ended up growing and selling cannabis, like seed to sale, back in the early 90s. And I mean, that's early when you think about it. And I mean, he served a couple times and under, you know, provincial offenses. And so for me, that got me very interested in, like, this is a plant. And like that coupled with the Cypress Hill album, Black Sunday, which went through all of these reasons about like the uses and utilities of hemp. And plus, you know, having tried cannabis at a pretty early age, to me, I felt like it was a performance enhancer, right, in many respects. And I found that, you know, to me, it formed an interest, like, why were doctors and teachers and administrators so readily, you know, ready to accept Ritalin, and yet cannabis, this plant medicine, which seemed to have been used for, you know, but for the last 97 years, was used throughout millennia as a medicine. That, with my lawyer mind, really got me starting to ask questions. And so really, because of the legality, and I mean, I used cannabis before you really had recognized medical exemptions and medical uses, that, you know, I guess it was really recreational. But then I found at university in the late 90s, when, you know, California, you had movement with medical cannabis and early jurisprudence in Canada, that, you know, that plus using cannabis, I felt like, to me, versus alcohol, how can this substance be so readily available and highly regulated, but available and like thrust upon you? When, you know, back in the 90s, you had alcohol companies targeting you and the medical profession silent on these harms. But again, realizing how cannabis worked for me and interacted with me, I couldn't believe there was that the two were treated so differently. And it wasn't until maybe a decade or so ago that I started, you know, using cannabis every day as a prelude to becoming a licensed cannabis user, just because as a lawyer, I didn't want to have any issues or problems. You know, the Law Society never cared about Ritalin because of the papers and the history. Well, they don't care about cannabis, provided, you know, you apply the same thought with it.
Right.
So really, all of this I'm telling you, coupled with the education and the struggles and the intellectual curiosity that I naturally have, you know, really has led to a perfect storm of why I'm relevant and useful in the cannabis space, because of all of this experience and context. Is very relevant to when you're trying to deal with regulators, police, government, schools, and so on.
And I want to get into some of those experiences you've had and are continuing to have on a professional level. But I do want to point out how interesting it is that art or music, Cypress Hill formed a moment of inspiration for you, as well as your brother's friend. And that you point to those two as defining moments. And it's really fascinating to me. So can I just drill down a little bit into your brother's friend and what, because most people in the early 90s were still very opposed to weed. I mean, except for the counterculture, the general culture was still the Nancy Reagan holdover from the late 80s of, you know, just say no. And so, but you're instead of being like part of the no, you know, just say no camp, you start to question. Why is it that happens to you? Can you describe what was it just because you've got that curious mind and it didn't seem like a bad thing, or what was it that?
Well, weed in the late 90s in the early 90s was a big thing. I mean, it was, in a way, it was almost used as, like, you had groups like Cypress Hill and you had the illegality of it, and you had, you know, high profile events like Ross Rabagliati and the Nagano Olympics. And so again, it just, you know, people being incarcerated over a plant, which again, and you know, and I lived in Texas as a kid. So really early in like grade one, we were being indoctrinated with the whole DARE campaign and the Just Say No. And you know, I can remember it was out of the sheriff's department and the Houston Police Department coming and giving presentations where marijuana, especially in a Southern accent, marijuana, you know, it just sounded like the most exotic thing ever. So, I mean, that plus, you know, people did serious jail time in Texas that, you know, it was this thing that you would, you know, read and hear propaganda and like government, this is your brain stuff, where none of that seemed to have added up. But my brother's friend isn't just some regular guy that grew cannabis. I mean, it was pretty ballsy in those days because mainly it was bikers. And I knew people at university who were growing weed that an associate of a certain club would literally show up with a briefcase. Sometimes it was $50, sometimes it'd be $35,000. But it was, thank you very much. We're aware of what you're up to. And well, let's just assure you, this will be your last grow. Thank you very much. And that was effectively a signal that you're getting in the way or we don't want you here. So for my brother's friend to do what he was doing at a time where, you know, it was truly organized crime, where he was doing it. I mean, he ended up being Seth Rogen's dealer for 7.5 years, which was also really funny because, you know, having grown up with this guy and just, you know, this was the thing. It was the early 90s. So unless you were in a biker gang or you were a gorilla grower going back to the, you know, the 60s, or, you know, you didn't have a medical program in those days. So the stakes were really high, and it, you know, so for having that kind of proximity as a teenager was very revealing. And the irony of it is I've met DJ Muggs of Cypress Hill. In fact, I consider him a friend. We've met a few times speaking at different events. His cousin is the CEO and founder of Bong Chocolates. But, you know, really, it was an interesting time because in the 90s, you know, you had a pound of BC Bud was trading pound or per pound in dollar value to cocaine. And in fact, a close family friend of ours was tapped as part of a Crown Commission into the organized crime. And so, you know, when people talk about the price of cannabis, it will never be as high as it was in the late 90s for a few reasons. I mean, you had on average $3,000 pounds were what was going for. That price would double once it crossed the border. would get as high as, you know, $6,000 to $10,000 in Texas and Florida, right? You would effectively have no money crossing the border from, again, my research, you know, you had all these interesting double entry bookkeeping systems where, you know, your weed deal would be tied or staked to a coke deal on two sides of the border. And so, again, you'd be stake points with no money or guns going across the border. Plus, with the exchange rate, what it was, so you had like an extra 20 to 25% of the American dollar versus the Canadian dollar. And you didn't even have to be growing like quality bud in those days. It literally was just, what could you get out the door? And so that is a good reference to where in 2008, when I started my own practice, I had folks coming to me that, you know, I knew who they were and what they were up to. And being able to tap into the expertise of like people that were 8,000 light growers at a time where things are legalizing and moving in that direction was interesting, because I don't know, it just has given me an inside out perspective of the industry, as well as a historical appreciation over the last 25 years. And so I can't believe this is what I get to do every day. Talk about this stuff.
It is pretty incredible that we get to do this. So, okay, tell me.
I get paid for it too.
Yeah, right. Ad Lucem. Where does that name come from? Why Ad Lucem? And are you, what's the trajectory from inception to where you're going with it?
Great question. Well, I can't take credit for the name. I was, you know, flipping through trying to figure out what my next move was after Gold Tanked. I was working with a buddy who started a gold company. So I was like, I got to do something else, and incorporated Ad Lucem, or incorporated a law corporation. But my mom was said, you know, going through Latin names, because Latin was a big deal at Oxford. And she said, Ad Lucem. And I was like, wait, what does that mean? Right. And she's like, to or toward light. And that really resonated with me, because I'm also a Freemason. And, you know, there's duality in absolutely everything. And, you know, in law, you meet a client and they're in a total state of darkness. I mean, they're like the uninitiated. And through the provision of law, or, you know, law and, you know, analysis, you're able to move towards resolution or enlightenment. So, you know, moving towards light, right? Moving towards resolution, moving towards a best personal self. And also a reminder of, you know, it's always the darkest just before the dawn. And that's ultimately, you know, in our personal lives or in our professional lives where we're counseling others, you know, it's always important to remember that dichotomy. And so really I look at it as Ad Lucem is a ship. Right. She's the ship, and I'm the master and commander. And that is the vehicle by which I'm able to sail and travel into all these interesting international and local circles. So, excellent. You know, on a side note, I mentioned that, you know, I've represented some pretty interesting environmental activists, and a lawyer that used to mentor me in criminal law had represented Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd. So when I met Rex Weiler, who co-founded Greenpeace, I said to him, you know, I can't tell you what an inspiration, you know, the early Greenpeace missions were. And, you know, your first ship was the Phyllis Cormac. And, well, mine's the Ad Lucem. And I'm sailing her into, right, I'm going to sail her right into City Hall. In fact, I ended up smashing her all over the steps of City Hall, running into her, dealing with cannabis reform and cannabis regulation. So I said that to Rex, and he put his arm around me and said, my boy. So that's kind of how I practice law too. I like to run into things head on.
Excellent. That's a great description. The Phyllis Cormac, that name, I just, as a personal note, I used that name with my wife. We wrote a play when we were living in Vancouver called Crude Love. And we named her character Phyllis McCormack based on the boat, because and Greenpeace sponsored the play, because we were
that's so cool.
The play was about the oil sands. So very similar interests, but I'm not a Freemason and I don't understand. Would you explain to me a bit about what a Freemason is and what has drawn you to it and how it's changed your life?
Sure. Now in our busy times and things are, hectic, it's always nice to be able to find like a group of individuals that have similar aspirations and goals and ideas of the world. And Masonry is really is symbolism through allegory. And what's neat about it is, back when in the Middle Ages, Freemasonry allegedly goes back to the ancient Egyptians and so on, but the modern constructs are the building of the cathedrals in Europe were what were called operative Freemasons, meaning you trained under a master and were part of a guild and a craft. And you have to remember, like, literacy was not a thing. So how are you going to communicate complicated ideas and concepts? So very much Masonry was about explaining the world around to the uninitiated. So concepts of using tools, for example, to explain concepts that we take for granted today, without giving anything away, for example, the 24-inch gauge, right, which is broken into, three times 8, 24, meaning that a Mason should live their life, right, by devoting 8 hours to a noble and worthy profession, 8 hours to to rest and refreshment, and then, of course, 8 hours to worthy service or to a brother or sister in need or in distress. So, again, it's very much about balance. And what drew me, it'll be coming up to 10 years when I was initiated, and, there's 3 degrees in Blue Lodge Masonry, which, again, you start as an entered apprentice, and then you move on to a fellow craft, and then 3rd degree. Is Master Mason. And so I was at a point in a time where I had just qualified and finished my articling. And when I'd heard rumors and rumblings all about Masonry while at Oxford and, London being a big Mason town, but it just sort of felt like it, at those points earlier in my life, it wasn't really for me. But 10 years ago, I was at a stage where I was like, okay, well, I've done all this law and I'm requalified, but I really don't feel like I have a code or, rules and a code, right? And, Masonry has been wonderful for that kind of structure. Plus, meeting once a month and just catching up with people. And what's nice is, there's really the only requirement of joining is you have to believe in, a supreme or ultimate being. Like, and that can be something beyond yourself, or aliens, or God, or a guy in a beard, whatever. But it's nice that it's open and accepting of all religions, faiths, and creeds. And, if you truly abide by the rules of Lodge, it's like a sanctuary. It's where you can go for a few hours and have a meal and festive board, as it's called, and, catch up with other friends and kind of leave your worries at the door. And, you don't bring in the religion, you don't bring in the politics. It's meant more of about brotherhood and fraternal association. Now, of course, that model and that venue, allegedly is, there's all these conspiracy theories and rumors out there. But really, that's what Masonry is at the end of the day. And yeah, it fills a gap that needed to be filled in my life.
Right on. Excellent. And you bill yourself as an international lawyer and you have your training is abroad in the UK and you work in the States. Like, where else do you, when you say you're international, what does that mean? And how does that inform?
Sure. Well, I look at it as, I studied political science and international relations as my undergrad. And if I wasn't doing law, another career other than being a war correspondent, which I do very much feel like a correspondent in the drug war with what I do, but that would be a working as a stringer or a political risk analyst, right? And that is effectively where my interest initially in international affairs and international relations is as a viewpoint to strategy and understanding globalization. And so applying that with an understanding of public international law, with an interest in private international law, and having been qualified and trained fully in England as a solicitor and then back in Canada as a barrister solicitor, and having lived in Europe and the United States, that before you even bring in the law and the international law pieces is, were the foundations for that. But with doing cannabis law and having made a little bit of a name for myself here, there, in a few places and different, these have been in other jurisdictions. So, I get different groups or companies that retain me or bring me in as an advisor to help navigate the waters. But most recently, I've joined a cannabis management consultancy firm based in Denver, Colorado, called Gateway Proven Strategies, or GPS Global, which is a team of pretty elite cannabis professionals that collaborate to execute on large cannabis projects internationally as well as within the United States. So that has been a great opportunity for me to have a deeper team and a bench to be able to hunt and kill larger projects and work that, one, is outside of the jurisdictions of where I'm licensed to operate as a lawyer. So it gives me a good foothill and experience to wear consultant and advisor hat. So that really is where the international comes in, because regardless of what you're doing and where you're doing it, you're going to have that local and international arbitrage where you're, as well as comparing and contrasting regulations, laws, conflicts of laws, and then dispute resolution if need be. So for me, I'm fascinated not just in what's going on in cannabis in my own country, but what's going on internationally. Because let's face it, you got more people in the state of California than you do in the whole entire country of Canada. So different markets, different skills. And I'm going to be speaking in Mexico City. I've been asked by a group called the Amsterdam Institute to do an 8-part lecture series that they're going to record and then dub into Spanish that will be, targeted to Spanish-speaking LATAM market. So, if that doesn't make you genuinely international, then just, I completed my law schooling in England and qualified Canada. I don't know what else does.
That sounds like a fun gig.
I'm light on UN experience, but there's only a matter of time.
that's up next. Good. So, but with the Mexico gig, are you going to be talking about the benefits of legalizing in Mexico? I mean, because Mexico was slated to be legalized like two years ago. They're stalling. What's going on down there?
Let me clarify there. So I'm not going to talk about Mexico, but it'll be an invaluable opportunity for a week to get my head around more of what's going on. But no, I'm being asked to talk about Canada. So the cool thing is my lecture really is going to comprise of 8 episodes. First episode will be like the cannabis prohibition experience. So that kind of gets you in the early periods of hemp right up to like prohibition through episode 2 and 3 will be part 1, part 2, the litany of litigation. So a quick whistle stop tour starting with Parker, like Stavropoulos, Barron, Smith, Allard. Maybe a look at the test case in parts 1 and 2. And then that gets us to the Cannabis Act. So we'll then have episode, 4 and what are we at? Yeah, 4 and 5 will be like Cannabis Act regulations. And then, 7 will be future, or what's the future for Canada? So we can like look at a bit about what's happening with these recent consults that the federal government are looking for insights, because the laws will be amended in the next, 2 to 3 years. And then the last episode, just to sort of round it off and tie it down with a look at, well, what's happening internationally and some other considerations. So I can kind of tie in some high level points and then maybe a little bit of psychedelics and end it there.
Beautiful. That sounds awesome.
Are you paying me to come down and all expenses? And
fantastic.
I'm going to be hanging out as well next month. Next month's busy. I'm going to Texas to speak at a conference in Dallas. They have Delta, they call it the CBD Delta 8 Hemp Expo, because they can't use cannabis in the name or marijuana because it's still Texas. And then I'll be in Denver. Going to go to New Mexico to see a buddy of mine who's a proper old school grower. I mean, he's credited for bringing Sensimilla from Mexico to Northern California in the early 70s.
Wow.
And was a big time grower in Mendocino County in the old days. And he's currently working on, or he's been on a Hulu documentary called Sasquatch. And now Hulu's working on another documentary with him. And then I'll be back in Denver, Kelowna, Vancouver, and then Mexico City. So yeah, April's nuts, but I'm excited to be traveling and spreading the good word.
My God, that's April travel for you? That's incredible.
Yeah, I leave March 30th for Texas, and then I'm home for a few days on the island, and then back to Vancouver to get to Denver to New Mexico. I'm renting a car. I'm going to just kick-ass drive like proper Wild West from Denver to like Las Vegas, New Mexico. And I mean, you Google or the Wikipedia about Las Vegas, New Mexico, where my friend lives, it says this historian describes it as like it was literally the hideout city for the most despicable gang of outlaws, including Jesse James, Billy the Kid, Doc Holliday. So to me, it sounds like my kind of town.
Fantastic. Right on. Well, okay. You touched on in your 8-part series coming up, legalization, the Cannabis Act. So walk me through your thoughts on, now that we're over 3 years into legalization here in Canada, walk me through your thoughts on the pros and cons. And is it a good thing that we legalized here?
You know what? It's never a bad thing when you move the needle or the stick back to where it should have been. I mean, I'm a big believer that cannabis should never have been illegal in the first place. And in fact, it'll be really interesting to see how the United States pivots and backpedals and justifies not only regulatory and legal changes in the States, but internationally, because we have to largely remember that it was the United States, through either monetary incentives or the barrel of a shotgun, was pretty much what got the international community into the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act. Because technically what Canada is doing under the G7 legal framework, I mean, it's still technically illegal at the international level, because this is outside of medical access, which we have and was a good system, and scientific discovery. So really, I think this is why the backdrop to which Trudeau legalized, because, they got to undo the past, but they can only undo it so far without slamming into the walls of the United Nations and the U.S. federal military industrial complex justice system, right? Like all of that machine, which is the U.S. So where does that leave us? Well, I think there's overreach in the Cannabis Act for one thing. If I had the ear of any provincial premier, I would basically be telling them that, look, who and which provinces will be the first to stand up to say, look, you federal government, if you could justify the legalization of this scheduled narcotic in the first place to a point that it's recreational, then clearly that should fall under the provincial headings of our constitutional separations of power under 9213, which is provincial trade and industry. And so what pisses me off, if I can say that, is that, like, and especially in BC, like, we invented the pot game and now we've literally been sidelined by Ontario. And what pisses me off is that John Horgan and Farnsworth think that, you know, just like what we've been given will work. But ultimately, the Cannabis Act forces upon provinces the shitty end of the stick, when ultimately the provinces should say, federal government, you get the medical program and you can regulate the criminal law and so on. But when it comes to provincial trade and industry, I mean, Alberta doesn't go to you for a license on drilling for oil. BC doesn't go to you for licenses to cut down trees or forestry or the filming industry. Why do we got to do that here, especially in an industry which we can grow outside almost the whole year round, unlike the rest of Canada? And we have the cheapest hydroelectricity, unlike the rest of Canada. So to me, I look at it as the legal framework that we have is ultimately, when you couple that with the way the provinces have gone about distribution and sales and the way that the product or the consumer accesses the product, it really has had the opposite effect. I mean, it's just reinforced the ease and accessibility of the black market. And ironically, without the black market, they're the only ones that have kept the legal market honest with, you know, twice the price for half the quality in the legal market. And so you literally have companies that are dying on the vine because it's not commercially profitable or feasible to bring this commodity to market. And so, like, I've been hearing stories on $100 ounces now. And I mean, the price of legal weed in the legal stores has come down to where I was amazed that, like, 2 weeks ago, I went in and, like, you had like a number of ounces that were at $100, some were more, but that's about $135 or so when you add on the taxes. So, I mean, still, that for some decent weed is not bad. It's still too high, in my opinion, for what it is at the end of the day. But the problem is for an ounce selling in a government store or a private retail store at $100 before the taxes, my understanding is the producer gets like 50 to 56 bucks of that. So, like, where is the incentive when a black market grower can probably sell that ounce for easily 100 to 150, right? Market value. And they don't have the government, who's really doing nothing other than getting in the way, reaping the kind of financial reward. So what I'd like to see changed is provincial government stepping up and saying, you know, for lack of a better word, thank you, but we're done. We're going to do this under a provincial heading. Sue us if you want, but what are you going to do about it at the end of the day? And then that puts BC and the provinces in the driver's seat for dealing with international trade. Because at the moment, the federal government gets to dictate that. So what does that mean for the provincial producer? It means that they're being practically regulated into irrelevancy. And how is a BC craft producer going to have any kind of ability to compete internationally when the price of cannabis is only going to drop further as more companies and supply get online? And that's interesting because any artificial attempts for governments to cap production will just be greener lights for the black market and other illicit production. So we're nowhere closer unless government gets out of the way.
Okay, so you've raised so many great issues, one of which is the federal licensing for producers. So what really, I mean, practically speaking, you apply, you get your facility, you get your license, either whether it's a standard or micro, to grow. At that point, really, it's just a matter of reporting, isn't it, to Health Canada and seldom the inspection. I mean, there isn't really that much that the federal government is, you know.
What they're doing is you're artificially capping the industry, right? Where you have, if the only distinction between a macro and a micro is half of the neutral zone on an ice rink, which is that square footage, which again, it was brought in, I believe it wasn't brought in to give the little guy a chance. I mean, the little guy had just as much chance as the big guy with macro licenses. At the end of the day, what it was about was because you had your canopies and your top 20 LPs that by volume and size in those early days, is it enabled them a position that any kind of a smaller producer could only grow and be of such a size, meaning it would be perfect for these larger companies to start acquiring the smaller companies, because it literally is like putting fish in a barrel and letting the LP shoot at them with respect to acquisitions. And that was the thought, that, you know, this industry would be so profitable and the craft market, so on and so forth. Now, that's not to say there aren't some folks doing well, and there are, but the end of the day, there should be bands of license. If you want to grow a hectare of cannabis outside and you're able to do that and you can manage and control that property and mitigate theft and complications, then you should be allowed to do it. Just like if you want to grow a bespoke craft product, then you should be allowed the same latitude as the small craft brewers. I mean, some of the best microbrewers in Vancouver started out of homes in East Vancouver.
Right.
And it's crazy to think that they're given liquor licenses and money from government in order to become an established player. But, you know, you have a medical grower growing in their home, and think about it. What other licensed industry do they allow to operate from a dwelling home? It's usually zero. So really, this is where there has to be bans so that companies can economically, at the right scale, be able to produce something and do it at a level of profitability, and yet they can't. And so that, to me, is where the black market is winning, the industry is losing, and ultimately the government is perpetuating this.
Let's talk a bit about the black market for a second here. So everybody knows that many black market growers, and maybe black market is the wrong, I don't know, I'm torn on this term black market versus underground or original or was the other one is
red market,
legacy market, red market. I haven't heard that.
What the First Nations have been, you know, and that's not my term. That's their term. And so I look at it as you've got different colors. There's black, there's gray, there's red, and there's white. And maybe green is the ones of that lot that are making profit. right. But that's sort of the way I see it. And if you're going to end up with band to band, nation to nation trade, there will be some latitude for those folks to be able to do things that if you or I tried to do that, Health Canada would say no way.
Okay. So let's take it down to the nitty gritty then. Do we even need a Cannabis Act, really? Because isn't the Cannabis Act just the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act modified? Isn't it kind of a rebranding of the CDSA with the promotion and marketing provisions and packaging provisions put in there from the Tobacco and Vaping Products Act? I mean, really, the Cannabis Act is just another criminal statute, right? So do we need this act anymore? Is it just a hindrance to the actual reality of what's going on in the country?
You know, I can answer your question with a rhetorical question, which, you know, was the Food and Drug Act and the Food and Drug Regulations, inappropriate to deal with cannabis at the end of the day? Cannabis is a food, it is a drug, and there's a whole points in between. But yet we had to, through all this pomp and circumstance, create the Cannabis Act. Well, do we need the Lettuce Act, the Tomato Act, the Mushroom Act, the, you know, we used to laugh because you'd see just across the city line from East Van into Burnaby, you'd see these fruit vendors, right? With little stalls selling blueberries or apples or whatever was the bill of fare of the day. And I'd say to my honey or my wife, honey, you know, I sure hope that's licensed produced fruit over there. You know, we better hope that's not any black market or, you know, health and safety or kids getting access to that unlicensed, unregulated, non-LP illicit fruit, right? And it just, when you look at it within that context of how everything else is regulated, it really seems silly. But the reality is, if government think they can regulate it and should regulate it, they will regulate it. And you only have to look at the, you know, history from, like, you know, the 1900s to present day. I mean, you know, you had very little regulation. You know, it started with like the Town and Country Act with municipalities regulating. And now it's like every facet of our life is regulated and overregulated to the point that maybe there should almost be a movement towards anti-regulation and lobbying of government. You go and keep the playing field fair and allow the rest of us to carry on, and we'll pay our taxes, right? But you look at similarities of how you can't even have homogenized or belong to a milk co-op and have unhomogenized milk and cheese without Health Canada showing up and seizing the cow, which, if you think I'm BSing, my former paralegal was a member of a cow co-op and the federal government took the cow.
The milk wars, that those are some seriously good case law. If everybody listening to this now doesn't know about the milk wars in BC, definitely read up on those. Those are amazing cases, crazy cases.
But it's like government with liquor too in BC. It's almost like the government's got to stop saving us from ourselves, because but really infuriates me and it excites me at this anytime I go to a Costco in the United States. Like, you got liquor, tobacco, firearms, you know, all sorts of other regulated product. And it's almost like an insult. Are we too stupid in Canada to be able to, like, conduct ourselves accordingly, that if we wanted to access these products as and when appropriate, we should be allowed? I mean, I lived in Texas as a kid, which I love it when I go to Alberta, because Alberta is literally the Texas of the North. And then you look at BC and it's like, wow, the shit we put up with in BC. But the reality is everyone is so quick to self-regulate themselves to try to get in with the government that it's this terrible, like, self-reinforcing cycle. So I'm almost given up on what's going to happen in Canada. I almost don't care what's going to happen in Canada, because regardless of Canada, the world is legalizing, regulating, supplying. And we only have to look at history, where the price of Indian hemp weed, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture in 1935, the year before the 1936 Stamp Act, you ready for it? 37 cents a pound. Right. And you got folks now trying to grow weed in a bank vault, right? And pass it off that this agricultural commodity is now a pharmaceutical product. And, you know, if the government's going to continue to be stupid, that's on them. But, you know, to say,
Robert, what about the health and safety of our children, right? The whole thing was predicated on saving the children, protecting the children, and saving us from biker gangs and organized crime. Okay, so where is this on? Where are you on that?
There are two points on that, right? The minute that federal government can control and curtail the flow of drugs in and out of federal penitentiaries, then they'll be in a position to engage in a dialogue on how to address that problem outside of circumstances that they don't control under armed guard, lock and key. That's one. Secondly, can you still buy nuts in a grocery store? Nuts kill people. Cannabis doesn't. I think the last time ever cannabis killed somebody might have been when a grouper out of a plane hit somebody in the head jogging, right? But I can only speculate there. But ultimately, no. I am way more comfortable with my children being around cannabis than I am with anything that traditionally you'd find in a medicine cabinet or under the sink. And, you know, to me, when I look at the fact that, you know, I, as a child, I was given access to Ritalin. My parents would put it in tinfoil in my lunch bag and, you know, I'd take it. And trust me, the teachers knew if I didn't, and everyone was a lot happier when I did. No problem. But now you hear about kids getting marched down to the principal's office and so on. But the nice thing is, you know, I am hearing from clients who, you know, they are working with their schools and they are developing strategies that do allow, children to consume cannabis, not on school ground, but they have a safe contingency plan for this. So, you know, health and safety, you know, the end of the day, it's a double-edged sword, right? There's other products that should be regulated under lock and key, but we don't hear anything about them only in case of cannabis. So
right.
I don't know, bullshit's what I say to health and safety, but that's a difference between doing things properly and exposing young people to these things the right way. But again, when you see at barbecues, folks holding their toddler in one hand and sipping a bottle of beer in the other, or mommy's holding a glass of wine, then, you know, to me, it's a double standard. And, you know, we shouldn't be tarring cannabis or access to cannabis by that brush.
It's fascinating that we're allowed to grow four plants in our dwelling unit with children around. And those plants can be massive, of course. Four is just the arbitrary number.
No one
number.
Can see it, apparently, right? That's the other caveat. No one's right. allowed to see it, but... You know, why shouldn't they be able to see it? Right.
So I did on purpose just to prove a point. When we got legal here, we got a backyard, a little thin strip of backyard here. And, I immediately put the four plants in, and I have no green thumbs. That's all terrible. I have no colors in my thumbs. So the plants unfortunately got powdery mildew about halfway through the season, but neighbors could see them. We don't have a lot of sun back there, so I'd move them around to try and catch some sun. And it was just an experiment to see with kids around what would happen. Was there going to be some kind of chaos happening? Were my kids weren't even remotely interested. You know, as soon as we tried to, I took my eldest over to see the plant. They look at this is a cannabis plant. He's like, oh, Dad, just can we just do something else, please? And the irony that yeah. one of the main reasons why we have a Cannabis Act is it was introduced at least into the House with this protection element that people are very concerned that, oh, if it's illegal cannabis, it's going to be laced with something and we're going to hurt our children that way. Well, don't we have a criminal code? Can't we rely on that for that kind of terrible offense? Of course we can. Okay. So, you've dethroned the Cannabis Act. You've taken away the idea of federal licensing. I want to you touched on this idea I want to go back to the municipal regulatory framework, because you put in there you had this interesting point about how we have cities now with incredible bylaws, and it's like we're codifying everything, we're regulating everything in our lives. And you had you represented one of the dispensaries in Vancouver that
I got the first temporary use permit, probably in Canada, certainly in BC, 2 years before legalization, because the mayor of Penticton had a 7 dispensary problem. And so my client was one of the dispensary operators doing things the right way and trying to get his ear. So it was a fun story, actually. Jamie Shaw and I, Jamie and I used to work very closely together, as, you know, I called her my dispensary expert. So we ended up supposed to fly out to Penticton. The flight was canceled. So we rented a Mustang and we drove up and we're there by the afternoon. And I threw my suit on in the parking lot. It was a scorching hot Penticton day. And then we went in and met with the mayor. And the mayor was like, I got a problem. I have 7 dispensaries and the RCMP won't do anything. And the federal government isn't legalizing for a number of years. And Vancouver had already, you know, tabled their bylaws in that regard. They hadn't licensed anybody yet. So we basically said, well, mayor, you're you can't rely on the feds. They're not going to do anything until October 2018. The RCMP are in this holding pattern that they don't know what to do. And, either they're going to start rolling heavy or they'll stand by. They've indicated that, they're not, and that's the thing. The mayor went to them and they're like, well, we're not prepared to do anything right now. So I said to him, you really need to consider regulating and, look at Vancouver. Here's the justification. Your 7 dispensary problem. That is like, that's not even a problem. That's Granville Street. I said that 7 dispensary problem is now maybe a 1 or 2 dispensary problem, because the ones that will get hit and follow the rules, then you don't have an issue with them. Right. But the ones that you really do have the issue with and the problem that you had before the others started doing it the right way, well, then you can marshal and prioritize your police and enforcement and bylaw resources there. Win-win. Right. So that's really what happened, was they rushed through a set of regulations. The client was eligible. We spoke to it and then they received a temporary use permit. So, even when the RCMP did go in, they had to then, effectively they were, turned away in that instance.
Right. Well done. That's phenomenal. And when I first read the Vancouver bylaw, when it was closed. Yeah. The Vancouver bylaw was fascinating because in Toronto, we were under the, we had about 100 dispensaries all around the city, and their efforts were to shut them down with it wasn't defined as a retail.
Project Claudia store. And Project Nader.
That's right. Project Claudia. So I read the Vancouver bylaw and I said, here is an enlightened city who understands the need for cannabis dispensaries because people want to buy weed, not just in parking lots and in underground tunnels or at the back of, some darkened alley. They want to buy it in a store, like regular produce. So here's a bylaw. And I thought that's enlightened. Well done. Well,
you're enlightened city. Let me just give you the flip side.
Because, go ahead.
I was legal counsel on what was known as City of Vancouver versus Karuna Health Foundation and others. And the others started as 67 of these dispensaries. But I can take credit because I went to speak to, I went over to meet with Kurt Tusaw and Ted Smith and Dieter McPherson and a handful of others just to say, hey, if I'm going to bring the thunder and the lightning on, are you guys going to support me and back me? And let's do this in a coordinated effort. And so really, the city we all thought was enlightened. But then they came out with the rules and you had 150 dispensaries plus. And out of 150 of those dispensaries on the rules of the city and the regs, they brought in under what was called the Medical Marijuana Regulatory or Regulated Use, MMRU. Out of that, 13 out of 150 stores, okay, were eligible. That is not a regulatory policy. That is an elimination strategy, right? So on the one hand, Vancouver, very progressive, very enlightened, which they are. I mean, at the end of the day, the chief of police, Adam Palmer, and his predecessor were of the opinion, look, we got bigger fish to fry in this town under health and safety, fentanyl, opioids, gangs, bikers, weapons, violent assaults, cannabis, and folks that are accessing it, not a big issue. And so the history of that is really interesting because, you had the BC Compassion Club and the Vancouver Island, VICS, Vancouver Island Compassion Society, around from about 1996 or so, right? Maybe even earlier, that the whole reason that they weren't licensed under or given a business license is because the city of Vancouver, in the case of Vancouver, didn't want to license them. They're like, no, we will turn a blind eye. And the police said, we won't raid. But at the same time, we don't want to like lose our bond, you know, our credit rating and bond status and everything else. Plus, in those days, you know, people genuinely thought that if Canada legalized, the U.S. would shut the border and do all these sorts of things, which they never did. They beat us to the punch. So that history of 96 to about 2012 or 2010, 2012, you started to see maybe 3, 4, 5. But by 2015, you know, that number had gone from about 15 to over 150. And it was 50 shades of green, I called it, like from dark legitimate, from the Compassion Club, right down to, you know, some of these other proprietors. And hey, I represented the good, the bad, and the ugly. Like it was, you know, I'm proud of the fact that I was able to get this kind of in-depth perspective. But ultimately, we ran at the city of Vancouver with arguments of illegality. And we have to nod and tip my hat to John Conroy for that, because we were all trying to argue Section 7, right? That, you know, and again, that the fact that the city had no standing to regulate something that even the federal government were saying, hey, you guys can't regulate that. And so we brought these arguments of illegality and effectively, you know, tried to demonstrate that the city, you know, either had jurisdiction, but they were fettering their jurisdiction. And that, you know, there was Section 7 access. When you look at the Allard case and others where, I mean, the courts are concluding that dispensaries are the heart of reasonable patient access. And so you got to remember, that's what Trudeau originally campaigned on. I mean, he was talking with Jody Emery in the early days about somehow Jody was going to be some MLA in a liberal seat and they would be bringing this legalization to market. And then on the campaign days when the Emerys were completely out of the liberal picture and Trudeau was actually campaigning on cannabis, it was that dispensaries were going to play some role. And then he got in and the litigation and Allard and Smith and the MMPR had to be rewritten, that when they came out with the Cannabis Act, it literally, they doubled down on ensuring that there would be no charter defenses available and that this is the will and demand of Parliament. And so that's why they keep jamming on the front that it's to protect our children, keep our city streets safe, and to take the money out of the black market. But when in reality, really the city of Vancouver, and you know, think about it. I mean, I got to give credit to Ian Dixon, the head of law, the head of the legal department at City of Van. He did spend his time after playing professional cricket in England after graduating as one of the top law grads in law. He then worked at the Attorney General's office. So when you think of it, from his point of view, he's got the Attorney General of Victoria calling, going, hey, Ian, yeah, it's the AG here in Victoria. What the fuck is going on in Vancouver there, pal? Seeing 150 dispensaries. What are you going to do about it? Well, AG, we're going to introduce a regulatory policy that'll make 13 of them possibly legal when we decide to regulate them. And anyone else will be kept in a holding pattern where we'll enforce them or won't license them, whatever. And, well, we ended up keeping that situation live for 2.5 years with the litigation. And it was an all-out war at the end of the day, because not only did we agree the rules of, like, the terms of war, like gentlemen, that we would resolve this in one venue before the courts, that, you know, again, the dispensaries would agree to shut down if they lost, and in turn, the city would agree to hear the case and so on. But then they ended up bringing action in the provincial court. So they had to turn up the heat now in a second theater of combat, provincial court and then Supreme Court. So it created a lot of work. Like, I was going to court daily almost. I had to bring agents to just delay and adjourn till I could finally, you know, shoot it with one silver bullet before the provincial court judge and say, you know, listen here, Your Honor, we've got a charter case dealing with Section 7, Section 2. The Chief Justice, Christopher Hinkson, has seized himself. Ultimately, the matter is set for court, and it's dealing with completely duplicitous issues as here. But I must insist that we stay, or you order the action stayed pending the outcome of the test case, because it's the more senior, experienced venue with the jurisdiction to determine the matter. So we don't know. It could go either way, Your Honor, right? And the end of the day, we went the distance. Ian Dixon threw everything at us. I mean, despite agreeing to hear the case, right, he then at the last minute decided to bring applications challenging whether we had standing. So we had to make private and public interest standing arguments, which were the only thing we won at the end of the day, meaning that we won that. We were allowed to continue. And like literally like Rocky One, we went the distance with Apollo Creed, the federal government. And then, you know, it went to where charter arguments were made. And I thought we made a good case. Like we demonstrated that if, you know, using the fact pattern of an individual with no fixed address or homeless or vulnerable population, not having a credit card, they're barred from the medical system. Mm-hmm. And under compassionate access in these dispensaries, they always had a $5 gram, right? Or compassion joints or, you know, tray weed rollies or something that, you know, they were happy to help the community with. But there was none of that in the legal space. So making those arguments, plus I was in the process of getting affidavits when the matter. So, yeah, let me just back up. The Chief Justice stayed the matter. Or no, sorry. He reserved judgment. So right. Between end of September to December 12th, we were trying to get patients and find patients who had signed up to the legal medical system and instances of where it just either failed them or didn't offer products that worked for them. Right? Like certain extracts at the time and different oils and concentrates and mixtures of the two weren't available. You had flour and oil and that was really it. So, you know, we tried our best at the last minute. The Chief Justice decided, you know, he ruled. We got an email saying that, you know, he'd be releasing judgment. And yeah, it was very clear that there were political issues afoot. Like as optimistic as I am of the legal system, I mean, the city of Vancouver had gone so far out on a limb, it was undeniable, right? That ultimately the Chief Justice threw them a lifeline. Because right. If we had won this, right? And oh, if we had won, it literally would have been what I told Bruce Linton when I met him. And he said, what do you guys think you would have accomplished? And I said, if we had won, Bruce, it would have been like me snatching your ball right now and kicking it over into the neighbor's yard and telling you to go get it. And by doing so, we would have moved the goalpost on the industry, meaning that now a completely unforeseen avenue of sales and distribution and access would have either been legalized or stayed, you know, pending appeal in appeals court and possibly Supreme Court. So, yeah, it literally was my Alamo. Luckily, I didn't die there. Moved on to fight another day, but like that was the intensity with which I took the endeavor. It literally felt like I had been manning a post or holding a hill for 2.5 years, and we were well funded and well organized.
Just to give it some time reference, so this is 2015, 16 prior to legalization.
So 2015, the city of Vancouver, after public consultation, which was awesome. It was like 7 days of public hearing and everybody in the cannabis space, like from who's who in academia to like old school guerrilla growers and activists to modern proponents for legalization. And then, you know, like Kirk, myself, a handful of others. all the activists, members of the public. And I mean, it was like 99% of those speaking were encouraging the city to, you know, consider legalization. And Kirk had spoken. It was a day after Smith had been announced. And so edibles should have been like, you know, put on the agenda. But that was one of the conditions, that edibles and things like that wouldn't be sold in these dispensaries. Yeah. So it basically just showed the city that they had to do something, and that the market was right. And the, you know, and so really what the city did is they relied heavily on Denver and Colorado, which was funny. And one of the angles we tried to fight them on was they said they relied on best practice from Colorado and Washington, when at the end of the day, best practice had nothing to do with land use in Colorado, because they were distancing dispensaries at 300 meters, which is what Vancouver adopted as the buffer, which they claimed was property use best practice, when no. And this is when we brought the heavies in from Vicente Sederberg in Colorado, the Rolling Stone magazine says is the go-to cannabis law firm, which the Chief Justice wasn't satisfied with that as an argument, making our expert an expert at the end of the day. But nonetheless, they informed us that 300 meters had everything to do with U.S. federal criminal drug law sentencing guidelines, meaning that if you sold crack in the 80s near a school within 300 meters, you'd be looking at a separate offense with an enhanced penalty, basically designed to dissuade people from selling near schools. And it's totally failed. And our experts basically brought evidence saying that all these states had to reduce their drug-free zone laws to implement cannabis down to 150. So technically, the city of Vancouver was very selective and hadn't applied correctly the so-called best practice. Now, it's a shot in the dark, but at the end of the day, Regina, by comparison, before the test case, had looked at what their licensing and land use regs for cannabis zoning, and they looked at 160. And so how can you justify in Vancouver being the highest, densest, highest population, grossest, dense, you know, urban density, where literally, you know, 300 meters canceled everybody out, hence an elimination strategy.
Right, right.
It was a lot of fun.
All right, but Hinkson, I read all the case law, and it's really fascinating case, especially procedurally, because you're as you said, you're in provincial court, you're also in Supreme Court, which in BC. I mean, it's kind of the corollary for Ontario's Superior Court, just as of her name. But so you've got the Supreme Court Judge Hinkson, who's Chief Justice, sitting, and he says in his judgment, you don't pass the threshold of Section 7 because access, there's reasonable access, right? Oh, okay. And he says you didn't have enough evidence, you didn't demonstrate that the bylaws were contravening Section 7, which is, just so everybody listening, that an ability to access your own medical cannabis, or medical cannabis in particular. So you said you got affidavits, you were going around town getting affidavits from medical users who either couldn't have access under the current regime or couldn't have their type of medical access they wanted, whether it was oil or different kinds of tinctures or whatever products they couldn't get. What other evidence did the Chief Justice need? I mean, come on.
Oh, in my closing submission, I indicated that I'd have to, in order to be legal tomorrow, because that's when I'd have to go to Kamloops to access my medicine or to get it recreationally at a legal place. So, you know, if the government is this sure that retail sales of cannabis and brick and mortar is safe to begin with, then certainly how we're doing it or have been or the clients should be considered. I mean, look, the end of the day, sometimes nothing is a real cool hand. And let's face it, we were dealing with clients who were selling illicitly sourced cannabis from an unlicensed business, right? in a manner that was illegal, and we managed to keep the stores open for 2.5 years, go the distance with not just the city of Vancouver, but the provincial government, the attorney general's office, and the attorney general of the federal government. But you also have to appreciate that this test case, it jammed the gears for a number of other municipalities. So in addition to Vancouver, there was like Abbotsford, Aldergrove, Maple Ridge, Victoria, Kelowna, you know, we had North Vancouver, Chemainus, you know, and this is just, I haven't thought about this in a while, but, you know, we had, it literally was the best game of Risk I've ever played in my life. And it was all of these dispensaries that outnumbered these municipalities. And, you know, we went the distance, and it turned out that, you know, we made some arguments. You know, at the end of the day, look at our situation. We told clients that, you know, if we win, it'd be an absolute miracle. Best I can guarantee you, though, is we'll make arguments. It may delay the inevitable, but, you know, we literally were handed a pair of twos, and we managed to get to almost $1 million hand in World Series of Litigation Poker.
What do you have now in BC? How is it working now for dispensaries, for retail in BC? What's your current setup like? And do you have any hope for medical access? Well, that's two parts of the question there. Two questions.
Well, you know, it's BC, so there's never really a shortage of cannabis anywhere. The problem now is you've got the community safety unit, which, again, it's just such an objectionable name. Like, oh, my safety and our safety was ever an issue from this activity, right? But in any event, no, you're seeing still there's a number of stores operating illegally. I mean, none of them are my clients, and I don't really do that work anymore, right? Because at the time, the rules were silent. The law was unwritten. There wasn't case law. The skies were blue and the fields were green, but, you know, we're a little more defined on what the law is and the rules and what's acceptable. And, you know, I got to be careful as a practicing lawyer too, at the end of the day, with some of these circumstances. But in just BC, so you've got legal licensed stores. Some are privately owned and others are government owned. And there seems to be this real backlash from the privately owned stores claiming that the government stores have a major unfair advantage when it comes to buying and sourcing the cannabis, which they do, which again is another reason that, you know, government ultimately are the reason that legalization is failing. Like they're involving themselves at too many levels, at too many like instances of the process. And so, you know, if a goal is to beat the black market or include the black market, making them legal, then, you know, they're not really doing a good job on that. And so, you know, the other issue is just the price of weed. You know, should cannabis be $100 for an ounce? You know, it should probably be a few bucks an ounce, realistically. So to me, you know, isn't that mean there's the role for this industry actually, you know, to be sustainable is either you're going to be a big multinational conglomerate or a really good craft small batch producer that enjoys what they do and loves the process and is using that business as a supplement to other business. I mean, no one says weed's supposed to be a guaranteed living wage, right? I mean, it was a pharmaceutical product back in the Victorian era. So what does that say about profitability and market? So, you know, again, that's why I'm glad I'm a lawyer And I reference John Grisham from time to time because as a young kid watching the movie The Firm, I mean that totally was one of the many things that inspired me to consider law. But Gene Hackman says to Tom Cruise while walking on the beaches of the Cayman Island, they're both tax lawyers, and he says to the young Tom Cruise, who's like a new associate, and he goes, "You know what the best thing about being a tax lawyer is, kid?" And Tom Cruise character says, "No, what?" And he goes, "Government changes the law. We advise our clients and government changes the law again. It's the circle of life, kid." Well, being a tax law is very similar to cannabis law because we're always advising and updating our clients. And the government is always changing the rules. And hence, clients are then needing to be counseled and updated. So given the state of the cannabis industry and what's on the horizon and the future, this is why I'm glad that I can be a full-on observer, almost participant, without leaving the safety and the security of, well, what I'm trained to do and what I'm good at, and that's practice of law.
That's a beautiful way to end our chat today. Robert, thank you so much for this.
Mate, I also have to acknowledge the work that you've done. And again, I thought we would have met a lot sooner in the industry because we've both been aware of each other. At least I've been aware of you for a number of years, and certainly your textbook, as well as the other work that you've done. And I'm amazed it took us this long to like either meet up or like not run into each other at a conference or on a case or something. But a huge shout out to you, your textbook, Cannabis Act, the annotations and commentary is incredible. I mean, I reference that book all the time. And it was so needed. And I'm excited to see what comes with that textbook.
Excellent. Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, it's a labor of love. And it was also born out of frustration, like yours, with the with reading the draft bill when it was just so frustrating. I guess I got one more question for you then, and that is,
I got time this morning. It's all good.
All right. One more, because I want to go on an imaginary trip with you in a way right now, because when you heard the first rumblings with Trudeau and his whole campaign to legalize and everything like that, what first image of legalization did you have in your mind? And what did it, like, before you read the act or understood what the law was going to be, what would your ideal legalization be like? How would it be different now?
Right. That's a great question. Just give me 2 seconds here. I thought we would be somewhere between what was in existence, right? Because these groups were allowed to exist for some of them 30 years, right? And in most cases, most of these dispensaries and this model had been proliferating in Vancouver and across Canada in some instances. And for the most part, it seemed to have been tolerated. Even under, Stephen Harper conservative watch. And then the Liberals got in and it almost was like they looked and studied the jurisprudence of Section 7 litigation. And they're like, how are we going to box and contain this in? So Tusaw and Conroy and Alan Young and Paul Lewin and the others don't shoot this down. And so that's where it was kind of disheartening that what was in existence, what was working and what really seemed to represent a fair and inclusive market was cut off at the knees and was nothing like what we saw. And ultimately it looked like we were a serious threat, that litigation, to the LPs. And ultimately what I thought was going to come out would have been something sensibly Canadian. right? I mean, you look at what was happening in the United States, which they, you know, despite it being federally illegal, what you see in Washington, California, and Oregon, although not perfect, and yeah, Colorado, seems to me a lot closer to a regulated form of what we were doing already, right? And so to me, it just seems like, why in Canada do we have to regulate everything to the upteenth degree that it's like constipating? There's probably not a better word, that I really think Canada is constipated on so many fronts, that, and that's really due to overregulation. And the unfortunate thing is, you know, not just cannabis, but like looking back at things like the Avro Aero, like aerospace, Canada always seems to get sidelined by the United States or overregulating itself into irrelevancy. You know, BlackBerry, another instance that, you know, I guess had BlackBerry pivoted another way, it would still be relevant and the dominant player. But, you know, this is what frustrates me, is that we are effectively creating a market that I think is going to be mediocre at best. And, you know, what's that going to say for Canada's ability to be competitive, right? Without doing what Canada does best, which is protectionary tariffs, right? I mean, that $5 bottle of rum in Varadero, Cuba is surprisingly $45 at the BC, or, you know, the prices set by the BC Liquor Control Board, right? Which, you know, frustrates me, because that same bottle of Havana Club is maybe $15 in the US store, right? So to me, it's why are we so complicit with allowing government overreach and overregulation when, let's face it, our Canadian healthcare system isn't what it was 40 years ago. It's badly needed of an overhaul. And in fact, some private competition in healthcare, for example, and in all industries, including cannabis, separate from the government and allowing market forces to determine some of these commodities, might be better for Canada. Or else we're really no better than Cuba, for example, although we get to leave Canada once in a while. But I mean, it just seems more and more, without exaggeration, that, you know, cannabis being no exception is really a casualty of government over regulation, which is a shame, because not just this, you know, asinine retail recreation, but we still have major roadblocks in front of us with respect to medical access and scientific research and stigma that, you know, these government regs and government rules, you know, and you highlighted it on how we've just taken and accepted the, you know, RJR McDonald tobacco litigation as what we should accept in cannabis. I mean, that's another element that we could talk all day on, but personally, it angers me. I mean, I spent my litigation seat in London sitting with the relationship partner to Imperial Tobacco. So I spent 6 months doing product liability litigation, or at least learning what cards these alcohol companies and tobacco companies are holding. And I mean, it was known these products kill people and cause cancer and so on and so forth. Cannabis, however, the jury is still out. And to me, it's upsetting that clearly a commodity that the Canadian government call medical cannabis under the medical marijuana access regs and then the medical marijuana purpose regs, access to medical cannabis, you know, ACMPR, there was always this medical, but yet none of that medical utility is recognized. So we have it regulated like tobacco with these silly little, that's the other bummer about legal weed, is reading these misleading health and safety warnings, right? Which, you know, is that true, and is that helping improve stigma and opinion so that cannabis can actually be studied, regulated, consumed, and engaged and interacted with the way it's supposed to. So, you know, I'm passionate that we're lawyers. We get every day we get to ride these waves and tackle these issues. But it's frustrating that more folks are not appreciative of the fact that these are rights that are an issue, and that government, certainly what we've seen with COVID and the Emergencies Act, and as of lately, continue to diminish and discount rights, freedoms, privileges, and how companies and businesses should successfully engage in profitable commerce. Because let's not forget, before I conclude, that the legal cannabis market is, you know, if you invested $1,000 in most of those companies and stayed in the market today, I think you'd be looking at about $200 in a gain, right?
I did that as an experiment.
Yeah. And then the fact that most of these legal companies are dying on the vine, and if they're publicly traded, their values are dropping, and most companies are putting companies on waivers and layoffs, and, you know, which then you see, oh, cannabis creating all these jobs. It's like, you know, seven people in the industry could very well have had 28 jobs, right? Changing seven times, which the government, you know, pick and choose their data that this industry is thriving, when honestly, you know, I'm checking for vitals of a sustainable live industry that isn't kept, isn't being sustained on life support by, an artificial position by virtue of failed government regs. So, you know, not a good time to be a cannabis entrepreneur, because literally you got to hold on to what you got to see if you're even going to be relevant when the new regs and rules come down, which means probably very little new market entrance until those rules and regs, at least there's an idea, because, you know, you're just hoping that your expenditure will end up being profitable. And I don't know, a lot of companies seem to be learning that the hard way.
Sure do. Well said.
Yeah.
I think we're going to have to revisit another chat sometime. There's still more issues to discuss, obviously. And I have to say, it's been a total pleasure. So again,
thank you.
Thanks for this. And we'll stay in touch for sure.
It's an honor to be recognized by, you know, again, other truly amazing professionals in the space. And, you know, iron sharpens iron. So, you know, this is just the start of, I think, a really great collaboration between, you know, you and I on a number of fronts. And, you know, I'm always... Well, always would be delighted to come back and continue the dialogue. And thank you again very much for having me as a guest.
Excellent.
Thank you for listening to Cannabis Law in Canada. As you may guess, this interview is not legal advice. And if you need legal advice, please contact a lawyer. We're always working on making this the best podcast for our listeners. So if you have suggestions for an interview or ideas for episodes, please contact us at cannabislaw.ca.